Hello and welcome to the Echo Chamber podcast. My name is Tony Groves and today we are talking about the migrant experience in Ireland, something that we've focused on for a long time on this podcast, but still, you know, when you see some of the stories that are emerging of late, you know, things aren't really improving and in some regards things are getting worse, and yet there's hope. So there is hope. There's stuff that is hopeful. Before we do that, bit of housekeeping. Live pod tomorrow evening, there's a live Glow West. And on Sunday, we are going to have the Tortoise Shack people together again. And we're going to be talking about the events of the week. And lo and behold, there's plenty to talk about. So do join us. The links are up on patreon.com/tortoiseshack. Click on register, come along. You can get to have your say. If I don't mute your mic anyway. Martin, how are you anyway?
Not too bad. Just want to remind everybody, look, stick the few bob into the Patreon account. Patreon.com/tortoiseshack keeps this thing on the road, keeps us moving, keeps me and Tony in the comfort we will never, ever get used to. So please, throw a few bob in.
Listen, much more importantly, we're delighted to be joined on the line from Cork. What is it with, we have nothing but Cork women this week, Martin.
I know. I think we've been accused before of being very Dublin biased, but I think the second city we go after is generally Cork.
Well, we're getting Dr. Sharon Lambert yesterday, and now we're joined by CEO of NASCAR Ireland, Fiona Finn. Fiona, thanks so much for coming on the podcast.
Oh, thanks a million, Tony and Martin. It's great. Delighted that you're having me. And it's no harm that you come into Cork, right? Because everything is very Dublin centric, to be fair.
We have to be honest, this is not a joke. If you people said to people, like, what is the problem with people in Cork, and they go, are they not happy up there? Do they not have the Giants Causeway? but no, look, in all seriousness, right, do you mind giving listeners a quick idea of who NASCAR are and the work you actually do, if that's okay?
Yeah, sure. So NASC is the Irish word for link. And we were founded in 2000. And we were founded actually in direct response to the setting up of direct provision. And we provide advice, information and support to refugees, migrant workers, new communities that are coming into Ireland. We have a legal advice and information service, and we see about 1,300 people a year. And that's across a whole range of different issues that they might have. So issues with their asylum application, with family reunification, with citizenship, residency permission, basically whatever the issue is. Because our immigration systems are very complicated and they're very difficult to navigate. So there is a lot of information out there, but it's just not enough. And I think some of the applications that we do are very critical for people. You know, they're whether or not their family can come in, or whether or not they get a residency permission, or trying to remedy something that's happening in direct provision. And people just need a bit of support and help. We try, I suppose, what we do is we work in partnership with people that come in. So we walk with them through the process. We also have a program that supports refugee women. And that's actually really, like, we've kind of noticed really through our work that a lot of refugee women can be isolated in the community. So we've just kind of got this small program running where it just provides a space really for refugee women to come together. Learn a bit of language and just kind of peer-to-peer support and support each other. And then we also run another program that works specifically with migrant children and migrant youth. So that's kids in direct provision, unaccompanied minors who are coming out of care, and migrant children who are in the care system or who are coming out of the care system. So that's actually quite a new piece of work we're doing, the Connect project. We've been doing that now for the last couple of years, and it's great. It's really successful.
Yeah, you've been referenced on this podcast, that particularly on that, by a couple of individuals. I know I've heard other people speak about it as well in terms of that program. But I'm interested in, one of your goals is obviously achieving systemic change, and you mentioned direct provision. Obviously, you know, it's gotten popular now to say that this is, you know, direct provision is the Magdalens of our generation, and this. The people that you interact with and you try help in the asylum process, can you just give listeners an idea of how complex it is and how how dehumanizing it can be?
Okay, it is complex. So obviously, so direct provision, as I'm sure most of your listeners know, it's how we house people who are coming in here to seek asylum. So when you come to seek asylum, first of all, you make your initial application in Mount Street in Dublin, and then you're dispersed to initially Balseskin, which is a big reception centre, and then from there, you're dispersed to a direct provision centre. And then I think everybody knows that direct provision centres, they're old convents, old hotels, it's all contracted out, it's all for profit. So you have people living in congregated settings for very, very, very long periods of time. You have whole families in some centres in one room. Not everybody in direct provision can cook. I think there's cooking facilities in maybe about 30 or 40% of the centres. People now have the right to work, which is very positive. It's a bit limited, but you know, it's a hell of a lot better than what we had. There was a complete and utter ban on the right to work up until a couple of years ago. I think in general the system is it's endemic with delays. People can be there from, you know, 4, 5, 6 years. And I think for us, when you're looking at the context of the COVID crisis, I think that really laid bare how absolutely unsuitable and inhumane and disastrous the whole system of direct provision has been. You know, aside from the fact that, you know, even if you look at it, if you people, so you could have maybe 200 or 300 people living in a centre. How, I don't know how people live on a social distance. People, you know, people are sharing rooms with strangers. They're sharing canteens. They're sharing bathrooms. They're sharing showers. It's just impossible. And then aligned with that, then having whole families in one room. And, you know, there were periods really at the height of the COVID, you know, when we were in lockdown, where you had families who were locked down. So you had a family of 3 or 4 who were locked down in one bedroom. And I mean, it was very hard for everybody experiencing lockdown, but it was extremely stressful for people who were in direct provision. Like, I remember speaking to one woman, and she was in a centre, and she used to carry her 3-year-old around with her everywhere because she was so terrified. She was afraid to let her down because she was afraid that if she touched any surface or any wall or anything, that she could contract COVID. So that's the kind of fear, really, that people were and still are living in direct provision, the system that we have today.
You mentioned families there a few times, and there is issues with reuniting families because of the delays within the system. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, sure. So we do a lot of work on family reunification. So in the context of refugees, so if you get granted a refugee status, so if you go through the system, if you come into direct provision and you go through the asylum process and you go through your interviews and you go through the 2 to 3 or more years and you come out the other side and you're granted a refugee status, you're then entitled to family reunification. What that means really is you're entitled to bring your family members in to join you. Now, in our experience, the majority, I suppose possibly with the exception of the Syrian crisis, but refugees, men tend to travel alone and leave their families behind. A, because it's safer, and B, because it's extremely costly to leave your country and to enter safety in another country. So they'll come out and the first thing that the refugees want is to apply for family members. And very often their family members have been left behind in a war zone. They could be missing. They could be in a refugee camp. And so we work with them then to apply for family reunification, to apply for them to be reunited with their families. Now, up until 2016, a refugee could apply for, say, his spouse and children. And also there was a discretionary application process whereby they could apply for, say, if a child had, one of the children had turned 18, over the process, they could apply for that child, or they could apply for, they might have children, they might be the guardian of children, or they may have brothers and sisters who had been left behind, and they had a pathway to make an application for these people. And it wasn't guaranteed, it was a discretionary process, but basically you had to show that this person was dependent upon you, and that obviously without a family reunification, that they'd be left destitute in their country. And since 2016, that all changed with the new International Protection Act. So now refugees can only apply for immediate family members. So that is their spouses or any children under the age of 18. So if they have any children over the age of 18, they can't apply for them. They can't apply for grandparents. And very often what we find when working with refugees is they tend to leave their parents behind, because obviously when you're looking at elderly people, it's very difficult for elderly people to make that treacherous migration journey. And we're seeing families every day and they're absolutely heartbroken. They can't move on because, like, they're trying to rebuild their lives in Ireland, but they have, say, an older daughter or an older son that's left behind in Syria. We have people who have family members in Homs, and there's no pathway for these people now to come and be reunited with their families. We did a research report with Marini Rahala and Karen Smith, which we launched quite recently, just trying to really kind of amplify the voices of refugees who had, A, been reunited under family reunification, and also looking at the refugees who were unable to do so because of family members that had been left behind. And it's just really difficult. And I think if you're looking at it from, like, an integration perspective, like, it's very hard for a family to settle and to rebuild their lives and to start rebuilding their lives again if all the time they're thinking about what the hell is happening to my older daughter left behind, what the hell, how is my dad doing, is there any way that I can get these people in? And we have to basically say to people daily, like, no, you can't, there's no pathway, there's absolutely no pathway.
And this is something. This is something that in Ireland we have done for generations. We would move to another country, and bring. And as you said, it is the men who go first, and it's the men who go first because it's generally tough and difficult to get into another country. They can work. They can set up a base, and then have people move to them. That's the pattern, and it's not just. In this day and age, it's what has always happened. So the idea that you see men first is not something scary. No. That's very natural. And also trying to get family members in. That's something the Irish have done for generation after generation. So this is the same predicament that Irish people have found themselves in generation after generation, up until very, very recently.
Absolutely, it is. And I think we have that experience. And I think, you know, we in Ireland, where I was talking about the importance of family, you know, in the constitution, the family is whatever the fundamental, whatever union or
it's at the center of
society. Yeah. So we are very much kind of pro-family. Now, last year we worked with Senator Colette Kelleher and we brought forward a bill. It was the Family Reunification Bill. And it was literally to reverse that, the erosion of family reunification rights in the International Protection Act. And that got cross-party support, which was really positive. But obviously, when it went to go before the Dáil, there is that issue of, you know, the money message.
Oh, yeah.
And I think that was a kind of a, I don't know, a tool, whatever, that was used for every bill that actually, so it blocked because the government refused to issue a money message. The bill got blocked. And then we brought the bill before the Justice Committee, looking at legislative scrutiny. And they looked at it and they agreed that it should be allowed to progress through the Dáil. I think when we're looking at family reunification, we're not talking about hundreds of thousands of people here. Mm-hmm. I mean, the average number of applications are, I think, was about 2.5. But you could say, if you want to put it on a stretch, it's three people. And if you look at, you know, not everybody that comes here gets refugee status. Mm-hmm. So again, that's bringing down the numbers. So you're talking about a kind of a very, I think, a blunt instrument and an inhumane tool, really, that has hugely damaging effects on the lives of refugees.
We have a few uncomfortable truths in Ireland that we have to deal with. One are the tools that are used and how some of these can be called push factors. There can be ways to make people not want to come here, which is crazy when you say there are people who've left war zones or famine or drought or whatever they're fleeing, their situation. It could be, you know, a situation around their sexuality or any of these things that they can't stay. And we call these ugly things push factors, and you use things like a money message. We had this joke yesterday, Martin. We spoke about the fact that one of the famous ones in Ireland has been, well, on a voice of the Attorney General, and everybody had to just stop talking then, you know. Well, they said, well, no, damn it, he's used the Attorney General line. We can't.
Like, if you look at that idea of it being a pull factor, right? So that really, if you think about it, so that means that refugees are sitting. So, you know, I'm in Syria or I'm sitting somewhere else and I've got a spreadsheet in front of me And I'm kind of carefully going through and I'm saying, well, now, if I go to France, I'll get this. If I go to Germany, I'll get this. Oh, I know, I'm going to go to Ireland. It's just not realistic. And yeah. it's never, there's no evidence has ever been presented to show that if you have a favorable and a fair and a humane reception system, and you know, a proper, humane, and effective asylum process, that you're going to attract more people to come. Ireland is on the far western seaboard, if you look at us geographically. Like, we get less than 1% of refugees that come to Europe, let alone the global context, you know. So we're talking about really small figures here. Like, you know, if you look at it over the last 5 years, it averages out about 3,500 people a year. That's not a lot, right?
Fiona, we haven't actually hit, and this is a, this is used the terminology, we haven't hit what we've committed to in any of the last 4 years. No. You know, we've said, you know, I remember when Enda Kenny said, Ireland stands ready. and we said, that was the phrase, Ireland stands ready. And what he meant was, Ireland stands ready to stand ready. Stand yeah. ready. And it yeah, was just like, but, and it was very clear, you know, and that we knew that. So, and yet, you know, we see creeping right-wing nationalism mm-hmm. and this stuff that mm-hmm. and then the mm-hmm. perception is that there's that this stuff is happening. Just on the systemic change to something like direct provision, now I've spoken to obviously Wendy Lyon, I've spoken, you know, humor, yeah. people who represent people and deal with these things. Is there anything that you think, you know, like specific that we should be pushing for, like, now?
End direct provision. Like, I think what we should also be pushing for is Programme for Government, for the first time ever, has committed to ending direct provision. Mm. I mean, it did appear in the last Programme for Government in 2016, and it was reformed direct provision. But when it was actually published, it was taken out. So we have a commitment to the end of direct provision, and that commitment is within the lifetime of this government. And in addition, there is a commitment to commit to the capital funding programme in there as well. So those two things are absolutely critical. So the funding has been committed to end direct provision, and also there is a clear commitment there to end direct provision. I think, you know, this for the we've been working in this area for a very long time, and it's kind of really over the last maybe, I'd say, 5 years, it's been slowly building, that finally it has kind of entered the consciousness of the, you know, of Irish people, that direct provision is just not suitable. It is yeah. inhumane. And I think the state got away with it for so long because, you know, it really wasn't in the public domain. It really wasn't in the public eye. You know what I mean? I don't know. It was very hard, like in the early days, it was very hard for us to try and get any kind of support for ending direct provision, you know what I mean? And a number of things have happened. So, you know, you had Carol O'Brien back in maybe 2014, 2015, did that seminal piece on Lives in Limbo. Mm. You had the McMahon Report. And also, I think in the last number of years, you have asylum seekers who have, you know, they've no longer got anything to fear. In 2014, they protested and they've organized. And it's having the voices and those really powerful and really, really, really strong voices of people who are living within the system coming forward.
The work of Massey has been phenomenal.
Unbelievable. It really has. Like, it's been incredible, you know. And that's really kind of been really effective to try and keep the issue alive. What I would say to people is, don't switch off. Don't think that, oh, this is a done deal, you know what I mean? Because it's not. It's nowhere near a done deal. And I think you can see, in one sense, I don't know, like the fact that the Department of Justice over the last few weeks, I don't know if you saw that they were monitoring.
Monitoring people. Yeah. So, oh, look, we were the least surprised by that because we're kind of aware of other departments that have been doing that as de rigueur, you know.
We are very much aware of that.
Martin likes to do his FOIs frequently. It was an eye opener to see that it obviously they could feel the momentum had shifted publicly. Yeah. And that was and the only way to get politicians to do most anything is to show that it will cost them their seats. I would, you know, we would say that the over the lifetime of this government might not be ambitious enough, but when we put it in the context of just before they sat down for the programme for government, the former Taoiseach said, look, you know, direct provision is grand. You get food, you get light, you get heat, you get exactly. you get a few bob. And I remember Ibrahim Halawa, who's been on this podcast a couple of times, saying, yeah, I got that in Egypt too. We called it prison.
Yeah, I know.
You know, it's very much to that mindset.
I agree the lifetime of the government sounds like a long way off. And I think what I'm kind of concerned about is there's not going to be a kind of a creeping, you know, that it's not going to, you know, that, you know, we're hearing, oh, no, because we're in COVID, you know.
Yeah.
And then you can hear the kind of rhetoric coming back saying, oh, it's going to take so long to dismantle the system. You know what I mean? Oh, it can't be done overnight. So yeah, I think.
And it can. Can I
say one thing on that? And this is, again, me speaking, so nothing to do with NASCAR or anybody else. It's just on the basis that Roderick O'Gorman, who is someone I believe really wants to do this,
yeah,
even the phraseology he used changed from ending direct provision to making it kinder. And when I heard that phrase, I just thought, "Ooh!" And I know I shouldn't, but words matter. So, minister, we are listening. We hear what you say.
We
will be listening. We want to hear ending direct provision, not making it kinder.
Well, there's two things, and the first is just a comment. I think if we look at the lifetime of the government, that might be a lot shorter than any of us think. And the other thing I wanted to ask you about was migrant workers, because they are very much to the fore at the moment, and the conditions that migrant workers are working in. And it's not very long since those in direct provision have been allowed to work, but it is again under very strict limitations. But we have seen that workers in refugee centres and by extension refugee centres have been very badly affected by the COVID virus. Are you getting much inquiries or traffic from people who are working and living in direct provision?
Well, when the lockdown came first, we got a huge amount of inquiries because everybody in Ireland was entitled to the pandemic unemployment payment, except asylum seekers. So asylum seekers who had lost their job had gone from, over the pandemic, who had gone from whatever their weekly wage was. Many of these were sending money back home to support wives and children back home. So they had to go from that down to 38.80 a week, which is just appalling. Then asylum seekers were asked to self-isolate in centres that were on lockdown. And again, they were told, nope, sorry, you're not going to get your illness benefit while you're self-isolating. You're not going to get your illness benefit if you're COVID positive. You have to go back to your 38.80. Now, that caused an awful lot of hardship. Now, I know, finally, that has changed. We're still getting an awful lot of refusals back from people who are now seeking to be reimbursed, who are seeking to get the PUP payment from when their application was processed. And we're getting an awful lot of refusals because the Department of Social Protection are coming back and they're saying, oh, no, you're in receipt of social welfare payments, so you don't qualify. So there's that constant battle. I think in general, in the context of COVID, we haven't seen firsthand a lot of kind of, say, migrant workers who have been working in the meat factories. But we do know kind of anecdotally, because from, you know, talking to colleagues, that they're a particular group that have been treated really, really badly. I think something like 80% of them have no entitlement to an illness benefit or an illness
payment. Right, yeah.
They're working in appalling conditions, really, really, really cramped conditions. Some of them, according to Ella McSweeney did a very good piece. She's very good on the meat workers. She's been chasing that down for ages, and she did great work on the fishermen as well. But she had a piece very early on in lockdown, even before the COVID started appearing in meat factories, and she spoke to some of the workers in there, and they were saying that they had been forced to work. They were told, no, you have to come into work. And you have, of course, you have these people and they're living in, you know, four or five in the same accommodation, and they're somewhat kind of blamed for that. Like, oh, this is your fault. You should be living in whatever, you know.
Three-bed semi.
Yeah, do you know what I mean? And I think that's problematic. And I think the other thing then that a lot of migrant workers felt and direct provision workers felt was that they were kind of getting stigmatized because, and we can see that kind of creeping up because like the Irish Refugee Council did a small piece of research there about asylum seekers' experience of COVID. and they were told that they were being called COVID people. So there's this kind of perception that's kind of very worrying that asylum seekers are the source of COVID, and migrant workers who were working in meat factories, they're a cause or a source of COVID. You know what I mean? And I think that rhetoric is really dangerous, and it's really kind of scary, because these people have no choice, you know. And the conditions that a lot of these migrant workers are working in are absolutely appalling. Like, they're horrendous.
And that's the shared experience across the world, by the way, of minorities and people of colour, and in particularly in the West, obviously, how, like, we've spoken to Philip O'Connor in Sweden, who said his neighbours are predominantly, you know, Eritrean or Ethiopian of descent and things. And, you know, why is there a higher concentration amongst these people of COVID than it is in so, well, because they're the people who are cleaning your toilets and doing
exactly.
all of it. They are the more exposed, and they have to go to work.
They have to go to work.
So it's not this myth of the other more susceptible, because that, you know, that has been asked. That question has been asked on Sky News. Are they more susceptible? No, they're more exposed because they're doing the jobs that you won't do. I do want to try and be a bit positive now. So here's some of the stuff that, in terms of the community and the social inclusion, the piece that you do, that's important work too. Do you want to just give us a sense of some of the community stuff that you guys do?
Yeah, sure. I mean, one of the things that we're kind of really proud of what we do, we're working with Department of Justice, the Irish Refugee Protection Programme, to do what we call community sponsorship. So it's basically, we're working with a number of communities that come together, and they want to welcome refugees into their community. So we work with them, and we help, you know, just prepare them, do the kind of cultural competency, go through all the steps that it takes. You know, when you come in, how do you get your residency card? How do you sign on? Basically preparing the family or preparing the community. And then we go through like a resettlement plan with them that gets submitted into the department. And then they get, for want of a better word, matched with a refugee family that are, at the moment, the majority of them are coming in from Lebanon. Mm. And then the family come, they don't go into an IROC. Like, the IROC is like the direct provision for refugees that are coming in under the resettlement program. They go from the airport straight into the community. And that has been incredible. That's been incredible for the refugee families that have come in, because they're coming into a really welcome kind of an environment. And it's also been really powerful for communities, because communities are saying that, like, kind of as a community, we feel closer together. We feel that we've gotten an awful lot out of this. And also, I know it's only small, but it kind of helps to change the rhetoric around migration. Do you know what I mean? Refugees aren't scary. Do you know what I mean? People can see how positive this is, what a positive difference, and how it enriches them and how it enriches their community. And I think those kind of programs are, you know, they're really important. And we're hoping now in the next year, we've got about 3 or 4 communities that we're working with to see if we can try and get, you know, for more refugees to come in under the community sponsorship program. I know it's all a bit stalled now at the moment, because the situation in Lebanon is not, you know, it's appalling.
Yeah, we spoke to a journalist about that recently, and it was already on its knees.
Yeah.
And,
it was, like, yeah.
And, like, you know, it was already economically a basket case, to use that awful phrase. And then you had that unbelievable disaster. But I do think the work of people coming straight into the communities, isn't that what good looks like?
I think so. That is what good looks like. And also, yes, you have a bit of, some groups get pushback, but because it's your neighbours that are getting pushback, you know what I mean? You kind of, there's a different approach, and it's like the pushback that some communities are getting is just an initial, oh, I'm not so sure about them. You know what I mean? But it's around kind of, you know, talking that through. And if people have genuine, and I mean genuine, I don't mean these kind of dressed up genuine concerns that are racist in nature. You know what I mean? People can, you can talk to people, you can, you know, make people understand and make people come around. No, I think it's really positive. And you can see, as well, the power of community in that as well, you know, and like within some of the community groups we're working with, there's people in there from all ages, you know, from kind of people in their young, you know, in their 20s, right up to people in that are kind of retired in their 70s and 80s. And there was one group that we worked with in Dunshaughlin. That was the first group we did. And the family that came in, the family that came in to that group in Dunshaughlin, they've now started their own group.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and they want to do it again. Do you know what I mean? And I kind of think that's really cool because that's coming from the group themselves. You know? But it has. It's been really positive, and it is. That's what good looks like. That's exactly right, Tony. Like that's, and I think that's the way to go. Like,
I'm glad Dunshaughlin is only down the road from me now. I am glad that Dunshaughlin is only down the road. Meath has been particularly good, and not, you know, right across the board, Meath has been particularly good and a particularly welcoming place. And I don't know if it's our proximity or whatever it is, but there's a great mix of people here where I am, huge mix of people. And we just get on with it. It's that simple. We just, you know, your neighbour is your neighbour. That's it.
Is it better than Cork? This Martin,
I quite like Cork, and I'm loath.
Tread carefully.
Tread carefully now. Yeah.
I'm loath to say
anything. It's a close second.
The last time I was in Cork, I saw I bumped into the Hothouse Flowers.
That was a long time ago.
Yeah, that was the last time I was in Cork. I bumped into them. They were going into a pub. I was coming out of it back in the day. So it's a while since I was down there.
Fiona, just to bring this to a close, I really do, like, people need to understand the importance of the family reunification piece. I want to go back to it because that bill was stalled ultimately with this money message. Former Senator Colette Kelleher is a force of nature. She's now working on a campaign for the right to housing. I'm a big fan of hers. But is there a way to resuscitate that, or is there a way the public could agitate to have that, you know, brought back or looked at?
Absolutely, because technically the bill fell with the last door, but it's within the gift of the government to kind of whatever resurrect it or bring that bill back. You know what I mean? If they so choose to do so. And remember, that bill had the support of Fianna Fáil and the Greens last time around. Now Fianna Fáil are, you know, and we had, like, Micheál Martin was in support of it, and Fiona Loughlin, who was there at the time, she also supported it. So I think what we want people to say is, like, well, you know, you committed to it, so maybe kind of, you know, just stand firm on your commitment, you know. And it's a small thing that's going to make an absolutely fundamental difference to the lives of families that are here. Because at the end of the day, yes, they're refugees, but they're families, essentially, you know. And I guess the way we look at kind of family reunification is, like, it's not reflective of how of the refugee experience. You know what I mean? In other cultures, people don't live in that nuclear family unit. You know what I mean? People tend to live, like we used to live before, in kind of extended family units, you know? Yeah. And I think that needs to be, you know, we have nothing to lose. We have everything to gain by trying to support that bill.
The state recognises the family as a natural, primary and fundamental unit group of society and as a moral institution possessing inalienable and imperceptible rights. Like, I mean, guys, it's in our constitution.
It is, yeah.
Like, we should not, this should be a no-brainer. Let's push back for that. Just for listeners' benefits, if you want to check out the work the guys do, it's naskireland.org. And if you want to put your hand in your pocket, it's naskireland.org/donate. Well worth supporting. Well worth looking at the community aspect and if there's ways that other people can get involved. Fiona Finn, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Fiona. Thanks a million. Thank you. Thanks, guys.
Tony and Martin, Martin and Tony, speaking to interesting people only. It's the Echo Chamber Podcast. Subscribe now on Patreon.